And now,
the definition.
It's the Real News Network. I'm Sharmini Peres coming to you from Baltimore. A general consensus is emerging that Trump's tax plan, which he presented last Wednesday, will benefit mostly the country's upper classes and corporations. In fact, the only people that got a tax increase are the poorest taxpayers. A quick scan of even business press headlines will reinforce what I'm saying. For example, Bloomberg writes, tax reform could open a huge loophole for wealthy Americans. And the conservative magazine's National Review has a headline that reads, Congressional Republicans' tax plan isn't great for Trump's suburbanites. However, Trump himself promised on Wednesday that he and the rich generally would not benefit from this plan. Here's what he said.
Our framework includes our explicit commitment that tax reform will protect low-income and middle-income households, not the wealthy and well-connected. They can call me all they want. It's not going to help. I'm doing the right thing, and it's not good for me, believe me.
Joining us to analyze what Trump's tax plan would mean for us is Michael Hudson. Michael is a distinguished research professor of economics at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. He's the author of several books, and the most recent among them is J is for Junk Economics. Good to have you back, Michael.
Here, Sharmini.
Michael, let's cut to the chase here. Everyone seems to agree that this tax plan will benefit only the rich. Give us a sense of your main points of why you want to contest this tax plan is beneficial for all.
Sure, it should be called the Leona Helmsley tax plan. Now, only the little people will pay taxes. But about the loopholes, the interesting thing is Trump said that he wasn't going to gain a penny. And he may have been telling the truth. Because that would be true if he's already paying a zero income tax, and his income tax rate is going to go from zero to zero. And that's about the same for a lot of the biggest corporations in America. Apple, Google, Alphabet, these companies that have been taking all of their profits abroad, trillions of dollars, supposedly, that they're holding abroad altogether, they haven't paid any taxes on because they've held them nominally in a teeny little office in Ireland or the Cayman Islands, claiming that they have to pay hardly any income tax at all. Now, the misrepresentation is that Trump says that now we can bring all this money back from these offshore enclaves, from these tax avoidance zones. The reality is the money's never been in these zones. The money's been in America all the time. Apple, Google, rich real estate companies simply hold the money in an American bank, but in the name of an affiliate, an office registered in Panama or some other offshore enclave. So there will be zero effect on the balance of payments, but it will just lock in their zero rate, enabling them to have avoided taxes for over a decade. I think 2004 was the last tax holiday. They'll bring them all back now without having to pay much tax at all.
Michael, another method that wealthy individuals and companies can use to avoid paying taxes is deducting investment expenses. Tell us how this works.
If you look at the real estate industry about the loopholes, since World War II, the National Income and Product Accounts report real estate is hardly paying any income tax at all. If you own a building and you're an absentee owner, not living there, not a homeowner, but absentee owners get to avoid paying any income tax because they don't earn an income. They pay interest, rent is for paying interest, or they pretend under the accounting rules that the building's actually depreciating in value, even while the building's soaring in value. It's going way up. They don't have to pay tax. And then finally, with the estate tax being nullified, when they die, they don't have to pay any capital gains. The heirs get it without having to pay any tax. The richest people would have to pay an estate tax, but that's being knocked out also. So I think that everybody who, as you pointed out, who've looked at the tax plan says all the benefits at the top, where's the benefit for the low-income people? Well, the low-income people are going to have to pay more tax. The minimum tax rate is actually raised from 10% to 12%. And people who live in Democratic states, New York, New Jersey, Maryland, California, will not be able to subtract the state and local taxes that they've been paying all these years. So the tax rate for wage earners, for people who actually have to file a tax form and declare an income, is actually going to go up, and the economy is going to be made even poorer.
Now, Trump and his supporters argue that tax reductions will make the U.S. more competitive, and it will lead to more investment. In an earlier interview that we had with Dean Baker, he points out that historically this has not happened when taxes on corporations and on the wealthy were reduced. So if it does not lead to more investment, what do the corporations do with this additional untaxed income?
They're going to do the same thing they've done with 92% of corporate earnings in the last decade. They're going to pay it out as dividend, higher dividends, pushing up the stock price. And most of all, they're going to use the money for stock buybacks. They're going to buy back their stocks to raise the price. They are not going to invest. And the reason they're not going to invest is the reason you would invest would be to sell more goods to the market and expand the economy. But most corporations, and certainly Wall Street, know that the game is over. The economy has not grown since 2008, except for the financial sector and the real estate sector. That is, except for the richest 5%, 95% of Americans, the economy's shrunk just like it's shrinking in Europe. Now, corporations know this, and they say there's only one thing we can do now that the game is over and the economies are shrinking. We're going to take the money and run. We're going to cut the taxes, and all the money that we get from whatever we are able to earn, we're going to give to our stockholders.
What are the consequences of this for us?
Well, if it works, it means the class war is back in business with a vengeance. But it's not going to work. There's no way that a group of Republican senators are really going to commit political suicide by going and actually voting for this plan any more than they voted for Trump's medical health plan and revocation of Obamacare. What this is really doing politically, though, is driving a stake to the heart of the Democratic Party. The Democrats are so sure that the kerfuffle over this tax plan is going to backfire against the Republicans, that the knives are out and they're fighting like they've never fought before against the supporters of Bernie Sanders, against Elizabeth. The Wall Street Hillary wing of the Democratic Party says, now we're going to win the election. We don't need Bernie supporters. We don't need the working class. We can follow an even more right-wing party than Hillary had. Her program was. And obviously the Bernie supporters and the bulk of the Democratic Party is not going to go along with the thieves at the head of the National Committee. And it's going to probably split the Democratic Party, because the way in which politicians are opposing the tax plan is it's going to vastly increase the budget deficit if it were passed. Just like the Reagan and Bush tax cuts quadrupled national debt, the same thing would happen. And so what you're having is the Democrats who are arguing against the Trump plan are budget hawks. They're saying a deficit is bad. Now, as you know from the people you have on this program, like my colleague Bill Black, myself, the modern monetary theorists, we're all in favor of having the government run a budget deficit if it pumps money into the economy, if it does lead to more investment, if it does employ more people. But in this case, the deficit isn't going to pump money into the economy at all. It's only going to pump money into Wall Street, and the money's going to be used just to push up stock prices, push up bond prices, and push up real estate prices and trophies for the rich. So it's exactly the opposite of the kind of deficit that we've been urging all along. So you're going to have a lot of junk economic theories on the Democratic side opposing the junk economic theories on the Republican side. And it's noticeable, you know, they're claiming that this is trickle-down economics and supply-side economics. But the people who originally introduced supply-side economics under Reagan, people like Craig Roberts, have denounced the Trump plan and saying this is a travesty of supply-side economics, because all it does is supply more money to the richest 1%. It supplies more money to Wall Street, not to the economy at large. And that's what really should be brought out. And I know that you're bringing it out, but certainly the mainstream press is not emphasizing this.
All right, Michael, I thank you so much for joining us today. And I guess this discussion will only continue over the next couple of weeks, so we hope to come back to you. Thank you.
A storm is rising against the privileged minority of the earth.
This is why I say it's liberty or it's death. It's freedom for everybody or freedom for nobody.
This is an NBC News Hotline special report.
We're at a turning point in the history of this nation. We need to stand for freedom. There's an escalating authoritarianism and even a creeping fascism. Freedom is precious. If we don't fight for it, you lose it.
This much is clear.
We must rebel.
This is our country. We have always lived in it. We were happy. Then you came. We have to protect ourselves. We have to save our country. We have to fight for what is ours.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, this is your brother, Vimer Dees. Welcome to another class war battlefield podcast. I have to tell you, it's been a great week. I didn't expect to actually do one of these. I have four parts to the White Lives Matter episode, so I was just going to turn them out for the next couple of weeks and let it go. But with the passing of Trump's tax bill, I knew I couldn't wait to say my piece. First and foremost, I'm not going to get into the details of the thing. You already know the details of the thing. If you don't, get busy. Get to work on it. Because it is... it's not enough to hear me talk about it, to be honest with you. You need to read about this thing for yourself. My suggestion to you is to go to either thehill.com, they've done a markup of it, I think it's thehill.com, or, oh my god, and the other one, there's a website that specifically looks at legislation, and I'm completely blanking on it right now. Wow. Anyway, You can get a pretty good rundown from multiple sources. I think ProPublica, I know they've done some stuff on it. I know the Real News Network, and I might actually go and put one of their clips on the beginning of this, but they've done a couple of videos on it. It's important that you yourself go out there and get this information other than me talking about it. And of course, you're probably thinking, well, wait a minute, that's why I'm listening to you, is to hear you give me this information. Now, There's a reason why I'm not really going to get into it in detail. First and foremost, before I get into what I am going to talk about, which is to do with the tax cuts, in February, or at latest the first week of March, when I begin the new structured Class War Battlefield podcast, you'll probably get sick of me giving you information, because I'm going to be really on point with information and talking about the information with commentary in between it, but it's going to be all about the information, so be ready for that. What I do want to talk about today is the signal that this is really putting out. I have this book from the 1990s. It's a great book. It's called Who Pays Taxes? And it really, it's a nice thick book. I think about 300 pages. And it really goes through all of the stupid things, even back then, and a lot of this has not gone away. So don't, you know, say to me, oh, well, that's the 90s, man. Things have changed significantly. The only thing that has changed is that people are paying less taxes, you know, people on the upper end of the society. But the book covers all this stupid stuff that rich people get to write off in their taxes that poor people never think about. Never think about. And it kills me because I talk to people. And they'll say, well, the reason why we don't have a lot of jobs is because of taxes. And if we just lower the taxes, then everything would be great. And I hear this a lot. I've heard this so much that it's, you know, it's almost like a mantra to me. You know, people, as soon as I raise the, you know, the idea of, you know, rich people need to pay more taxes and companies need to pay more taxes, first thing people say is, oh, well, then, well, we definitely won't have any jobs because people are sick of paying taxes. You know, I have a home. That's what these people tell me. I have a home, and I'm tired of paying so much taxes. And I say, well, then why don't you make the rich people do it? Well, no one needs to pay that much taxes, they then say. I'm like, wait a minute. You have to pay for society. Either you're going to pay the taxes yourself, or rich people who don't need the extra money could pay the taxes. Or they, you know, the people then say to me is, or maybe the government shouldn't be so greedy and shouldn't use all that money. And then I got to stop them and say, well, what is the job of a government? Well, the job of a government, I had a woman tell me this one time. She laughed after it. She goes, well, the job of a government isn't to take our money. Ha ha ha. And I said, that's funny, because the job of the government, one, is to produce money, and it does. It prints money. Technically, it doesn't anymore. I know the Federal Reserve thing. We're not going to get into that. But the government still authorizes the fact that the money is distributed to you. So, yes, at any given time, the government, if it wants to, it could take your money. And it does. But I told her, the government's job, at the most purest, simplest level, is to do the will of the people. And I stopped her because, you know, she went to get into the, oh, well, it's not doing it. So, like I said, purest. I'm not arguing or debating. Purest. That's what a government's job is to do, the will of the people. It's supposed to, in that level, in that vein, in that spirit, it's supposed to take care of the needs of the people, so they don't have to worry about those needs. In order to do that, they need money. They need money. So then they're going to have to collect that money in the form of taxes. Now, we have a problem here, I told her. The problem is that the government understands it needs money. But it doesn't know where to get it from. So we have to tell it where to get it from. Now, for 40 years, for 35 years actually, a little bit over 35 now, 37 years, what the American people have been telling the government is that it needs to collect the money from the middle and lower classes. And to stop collecting the money from the upper class. Whereas before that period of time, we told the government, you ain't coming to us and collecting our hard-earned money. We are making the least amount. You will go to the wealthy and the rich, and you will collect it from them. That is the least they can do for forcing us to work these menial, dull jobs. They can provide for our communities. So that is the problem within the government. Well, she said, never to be outdone. Well, why does the government still have to need that much money? Does it need how much money? The country is over 3 million square miles. The government has a budget, the federal government has a budget of just over $3 trillion. That technically is $1 million per mile. However, when you take into account the military, which is about half, and then you take into account intelligence spending, which is another 20%, now you're left with around one-third. So you went from over $3 trillion of spending money to just over one. And you need to then take care of various things that a society needs to keep it running. I might actually be overstating how much is actually left after intelligence and military. We might be down to one-fourth. But I told her that. And she said, but we need the military. And I said, nobody doubts that a country needs a military. But the country does not need to spend half of what it's pulling in on military. And I understand, ladies and gentlemen, I get it. Don't rate me and say, it's not half. It's only $700 billion. Yeah, there's something, there's these wonderful laws which allows the military to go into other budgets and say, we need money, we need this money for national security purposes, for the military. We don't have to tell you what it's for. And they do this regularly. This is not a joke. I'm serious. They literally do this. So we need this money for something. We can't tell you what. Thank you very much. Hundreds of billions of dollars each year. Between them and the intelligence agency, both of them get to do it. So that's why I put it at half. I don't even say the 100, you know, 700 plus billion dollars anymore. It's half. It's when you really put them both together, it's about 66% of discretionary spending is on military and intelligence. Even if I was to use the $750 billion that is guaranteed to them, and I think intelligence agencies maybe get around $100 billion that, you know, we can see. I mean, that's almost $1 trillion, and it's not unthinkable, you know, with all of the maneuvering that they do to draw money out, that it's actually $1 trillion. I really think it's much more than that, but that's me. even if, as I tried, as I explained to her, didn't try, but I explained to her, out of what is left, the United States puts about, from the federal level, $100 billion into education. That's about $2 billion. Actually, I think it's less than that now. Ooh, which is sad. But that's about $2 million per state. That's really not that much money. That's really not that much money. When you have a state like California, I mean, that's, that breaks down to like, I think that's about $1,000 per student for a year. That's no type of investment. No type of investment into your future. But we are, you know, aside from that, we have to understand, the people who pay the taxes are you and I. Trickle-down economics, and I've said this before, I'll say it again, trickle-down economics, what trickle-down economics was really about was to take the tax burden of the wealthy and to slowly slip it down to the non-wealthy, to the people with the least amount of money. That was the true reality behind trickle-down economics. Not this idea of, well, tax cuts, you know, we'll make jobs and then we'll trick. No. Tax cuts, you're switching the tax burden from those who could afford it to those who could least afford it. You want to understand, in the 1980s, there was a reverence for the working man. One of the most intriguing things that I noted, you know, I'm a product of the 80s, and technically not a product, I was born in the 80s, the early 80s at that. But, you know, with YouTube, I can go back and I can watch a lot of videos of songs from the 80s that I never saw videos to because, you know, didn't have cable. And one thing that is very evident is there is a reverence for the ordinary in the 80s. There was a lot of mood-setting videos that were shot in ordinary settings. And it was not unheard of for artists to be dressed rather plainly. The idea of wearing jeans and a t-shirt because the artist represented the common man was there because of the common man. Even some of your, quote, teen idols, even they weren't glitzy. I mean, they could still do the glitzy thing, but it was still all about looking somewhat ordinary. And so, with that kind of an atmosphere, there was a deliberate attempt, and it was successful too, to motivate the ordinary man and woman to see their lot in life as being connected to the extraordinarily wealthy. So that government became the big bad wolf, going after hard-working, hard-earning, wealthy people who did nothing to deserve having to pay taxes for the society. The interesting part about this was, during the same time, wages were stagnating. They were decreasing, in fact, enabling big businesses to reap more profits. A lot of big businesses made a killing off of keeping wages stagnant. And they were making tons of money. But they still kept them stagnant so they can make more money. And yet they were saying they didn't need to pay taxes that would have still improved the lives of the people who were working in their companies. Now, it's also interesting to me that a lot of the people who rose to prominence during this time period, who rose to the top of these corporations, were baby boomers. They were baby boomers. These were people who, if it had not been for a very communalistic fervor in the country, would have not had the advanced living conditions that they enjoyed. If it had not been for the sacrifices of the generation prior to them, and I mean sacrifices, I'm talking about massive work stoppages, strikes, people getting beaten half to death, people getting hospitalized because they were going against the barons of Wall Street and industry, people getting murdered because they dared to organize unions. If it had not been for this sacrifice, and I ain't even touching the civil rights aspect of it now, because all of that was in there. We don't like to talk about it, but all of it was in there. You had civil rights along with the labor movement. The labor movement, unfortunately, doesn't have a good civil rights track record. But if it had not been for that, these baby boomers would have never enjoyed the life that they had. And don't get it twisted, because you know, people will write me and say, well, World War II had something to do with it. The GI Bill was a socialist bill that originally had been promised to World War I veterans, but it wasn't given to them. And if it had not been, I guarantee this, if it had not been for the threat of radicalism in the 30s and the 40s, the GI Bill would have never come about. Franklin Delano Roosevelt went extraordinarily left because of radicalism, because of strong labor movement and labor unions. He went dramatically to the left, and the government would have never responded the way that it responded if it hadn't been for that sacrifice. And yet, it is this generation that handed all of those victories. It is the baby boomer generation that handed all of those labor victories back and said, we don't want them anymore. It was this group of people who started rising to prominence at this time and allowed that to happen. Now, of course, people would say, well, wait a minute. You had an older generation also in their 50s and 60s. A lot of these people also held prominent positions in these companies. And they're right. You're right. But remember something that they used to talk about. Remember the young urban professionals, the yuppies? The yuppies, at the youngest age, were born in the mid-60s. More middle age, you're talking about 30, 35 years old. Those are the baby boomers. Those are the ones who are starting to exert influence. When you're talking 35 years old, a person was born in 1950s. In the late 1940s. These are the people who were coming into their prime. And they are the ones who led the Reagan Revolution. Like I said, they're the ones who gave it all back. They took what their grandparents did. They took what their grandparents did and they gave it all back. Some of them even took what their parents did and just gave it away. See you later. Bye. I mean, that to me, it's still stunning to me. Now, this has dramatic importance because if I remember correctly, Trump was born in 46. I know he was a mid-40s baby. And it is right after World War II that baby boomer generation started. I think it was about a 10-year period. Some people put it at 15. But it is, this tax bill is an extension of that trickle-down economic theory that does not work. It is an extension of the hatred for the ordinary worker, the ordinary laborer. Note what Trump said. This is what's killing me, is people aren't paying attention to what he's saying. The news is spinning this in a very untruthful way. They keep saying that Donald Trump said, oh, this is going to be a giveaway to the middle class. That is not what Donald Trump said. When he was asked about it on the White House lawn, he said, if I get these words correctly, he said that these will be that this will be a giveaway to the middle income or the middle earner, something, one of those two words. Ladies and gentlemen, do you get what he is saying? He didn't say middle class. He said middle income or middle income earners, one of the two. There's a big difference. When they talk about middle class, they usually are talking about those folks who are making $50,000, $60,000, $70,000, $80,000. What is that? I think that's called your mean. That's your average. Your average person is making that. See, this is, now we're going back to high school here. That's your mean. So when they're talking about your middle class, they're talking about your mean. But what Donald Trump was talking about was your median. And your median is dramatically different. Your mean takes into account everybody who's working. So you got a room full of 200 people. You write down what everybody makes. And then you divide it by 200, and that is your middle class. Boom. Right there. But your median takes into account the amount of money. Not the amount of people, the amount of money. So in that 200, in that room 200, of 200 people, you may have people who make, let's say, $20,000, $15,000. I've been in that room where, you know, making $15,000 or less a year. So let's say $15,000. And then the upper echelons, you know, you got, let's say, $200,000. And it's all about where the middle point in that is. So you have $15,000 to $200,000. That's going to be about $100,000. That'll be your median. That'll be about $100,000. But that'll be your median. Let's say somebody like Mark Cuban walks in. It's worth, what, a couple billion dollars? Your median's going to shift dramatically. When he said middle income earners or middle income people or whatever he said, that's what he was talking about. He was talking about this is going to be a gift to people who are making $5, $6, or $10 million a year. He ain't talking about you. But the news has been spinning it as if he said middle class. He wasn't talking about the middle class. He was talking about people who are making millions. Millions. He has made it clear, Donald Trump has made it clear that he is not going to be for the working party. And let me tell you, for all of you folks out there who did vote for the man, this isn't me gloating. This isn't me gloating. No, in fact, this is me telling you to wake up. Because you have been lied to. You've been lied to for so long that you don't even understand that you have been lied to. You've been lied to for so long. See, you think this is about Democrats and Republicans. This is about vision. I don't know how many times I'm going to have to say it, but this is about vision. This is about prosperity for all or prosperity for few. Oh, that's about socialism. It is about prosperity for all or prosperity for a few. Oh, you're talking communism and socialism. That is red baiting. That's Marxist-Leninist. None of you have ever read Marx or Lenin. How would you know? Well, because I know, then you're an idiot. You know the number of people that I've run into that said that. Ain't never read Marx. Ain't never read Lenin. Ain't never read Trotsky. Don't know. Can't even spell the names correctly. Okay, you might be able to spell Marx because of Richard from the 80s, but how are you going to say that you know about something and you ain't never read it? That's another story, though. That just teased me. But this vision is about prosperity for all and prosperity for a few. Don't get it twisted. Right now, the country is heading for prosperity for a few. Why? Because this whole idea, this whole notion of states' rights, which is crap, continuously is just crap. Oh, well, states' rights. The states should compete against each other for the allegiance of businesses. And yet, you people tell me that you are the bearers of allegiance to this country, and yet you want to argue for states' rights? You have an allegiance to yourself and to your bigoted viewpoints. Now, if you look up the word bigoted, you'll be surprised to learn it has nothing to do with color. I'm just going to leave that there. You might want to look up what it means. This fantastic, by fantastic I mean fantasy, this fantastic idea that states' rights is going to lead to prosperity for all makes no sense whatsoever. And you know, no, I don't know any other Western country that does this and believes this. That if you allow states to compete against each other to lure businesses there, I'm not talking countries, I'm saying states, that this is going to turn out beneficial for the people living in those countries, living in those states. Now, maybe ultimately that's the goal of the people who's making this argument, is that they want the United States to disintegrate into literally a mess of independent states. Maybe that's what they ultimately want. But you're not fostering a good vision for prosperity for all. It also is possible that they know that it's not fostering a vision for prosperity for all. And that's actually what they want. I mean, truthfully, I personally don't see what can be gained by doing this if you are not rich. all of the conservatives that I know, except for a very, very few, are not wealthy financially, and they moan each day about how tough life is, and yet they keep going to the polling place and pulling the lever for conservatives who don't care. Now, as I've said in numerous episodes, I'm not even for the Democrats. I really just don't like them. They have done nothing to stop this over the last 30 years. They have been inept, and they look to continue to be inept. I will vote Green or somebody else in this next election, and make sure to take a picture of my ballot and send it to the Democrats and say, I hate you enough, I will vote third party all the time until you are either dead or you are reformed. This ain't me saying you need to vote for Democrats. This is me saying that you need to understand the philosophies that are affecting your lives. I'm tired of coming to the same people who have the same conclusions and won't listen to anything but Rush Limbaugh and the conservatives who are making so much more money than they are, but because they stroke their ego, they feel good about themselves. I'm tired of that. And yet I keep doing the work that I'm doing because I keep praying and hoping that this new generation who every day I see them, they are more and more tired. It's a shame when I see a 17-year-old with bags under their eyes. It's a shame when I see 16-year-olds that would rather sleep through the day than engage the day because there is just no purpose to their lives. And yet when I start talking to them about building a better community, they perk right up. Their parents, their grandparents, none of them want to do this work because it would mean you'd have to get a little radical. Yes, you would. But what are we really building for our society and for the generations coming? What are we doing? For the few people who have the money, what they're building is this political correctness soup of just nonsense. You're not actually solving any of the problems. I had to even say to a gay friend of mine who was telling me, you know, how great of a day it was that, you know, they could get married and stuff. And my position of it is this: great, you can get married. Actually, you should have been able to get married. I don't understand the reason for not letting it happen. Even from a religious standpoint, it doesn't make sense. But I had to tell them, because they've been on that for the last couple of years. And I said, look, you stop doing work on the financial issues of the society because you wanted to get married. We could have used your support on that, in that struggle. Glad you can get married, but now we need to deal with some stuff that's going to affect the whole of society. And our priorities are so shifted right now. And I stress now that, you know, I am not a banner carrier and banner waver for homosexuality. That's not what I do. It's not been what I've ever done. You will never hear me produce a podcast episode on that topic. I get people are gay. I get that people don't like to be in the closet because they're gay. Get all of that. I get all of that. But to me, the economic realities of the time period needs to be the main focus of what we're doing. I'm glad Barack Obama let him sign the legislation to say they need to be able to get married, they should be able to get their spousal benefits, things like that. Great. But at the same time, all of that was going on. The country was slipping into an economic crisis. And we're still in that crisis. And this tax plan is going to exacerbate that. Watch. Watch. It may get better quickly, but it's going to be a false reality. Things are going to get worse. And I'm saying this not because I want to be Nostradamus. No. I'm saying this because you need to start understanding. We need to start building community. This is the time to prepare ourselves to withstand the shocks that this system is going to have to go through in order to get itself corrected. That's what this is. That's why I'm putting this together. It is likely that this country is going to have some dark days, and part of it is karma, and part of it is just the elite have kind of lost their minds. We need to be ready for that reality, because it's likely that people around us, the elites, are losing their minds. People are so sewed into the movements of the elites. They have connected their will to the elites that they're going to start losing their minds. This is a God complex gone awry. When you have a group of people who demand loyalty and demand your free will. And that's, I noticed that with the conservative ideology. I noticed it somewhat with the progressive ideology, with some of the people who are part of that. But when you have that, and the person at the helm of it is lost, their mind is lost, you will soon get the people who follow that person to also be lost. Their minds will likewise be lost. And this is my fear. Because I already see, I've already heard, I've read what conservatives are saying. If Donald Trump gets removed from office, there will be a civil war. I need you to understand what that means for us. These people are talking like they're terrorists. And yet nobody is talking about their threats. So we need to be ready. We need to be ready. Because things could get ugly quickly. And that's why I'm doing this. That's why I made the decision to do this. If you have any questions, comments, concerns, I apologize, by the way, for my voice. it's been one of them couple of weeks where I have my sleep schedule has been kind of off a little bit. So I had stuff to do with the job that I have. Usually it's in the evening. For a while it was in the morning, so I apologize for the voice. But if you have any questions, comments, concerns, please reach out to me at the email above. I want to hear from you. If you're carrying the program, please send me a notice. I want to thank, by the way, the good people over at 93.3 KBHD and FM 104.9. The Gig, K-Gig, K-G-I-G. I want to thank both of those stations for carrying me. And, man, it's been, it's been a heck of a year. I will see you in the new year with more of these types of episodes for a while. Have a good holiday, y'all. Peace. There's a shadow on the faces of the men who sent the guns to the wars that are fought in places where their business interest runs. On the radio, talk shows, and the TV, you hear one thing again and again: how the USA stands for freedom, and we come to the aid of a friend. But who are the ones that we call our friends? These governments killing their own, or the people who finally can't take anymore, and they pick up a gun or a brick or a stone. And